You're listening to Counterculture on RCR.
Reality Check Radio.
Good morning and welcome back to Counterculture here on Reality Check Radio with Marie. Welcoming back now Sarah Henderson from Manawahine Kōrero. I can't believe it was February since we caught up, Sarah. It seems such a long time ago. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. February really does seem like a long time ago. So much has happened. Yeah.
Well, particularly around this issue. I know we had a chat about the CAS report a little later on, but around this issue, we caught up in February and we talked about the new guidelines, the scope of practice that had come out from the Midwifery Council. And they appeared to have forgotten a couple of key words in there, namely mother and woman. Now, just give us a quick catch up on what we talked about then and what has now since transpired in the last week or so since we caught up?
Oh, yeah. So thanks, Marie. So when we spoke in February, at that stage, the revised scope of practice of a midwife had been released on the 29th of November by the council. And at that stage, they were hoping that it would go into effect in July. And they said they put a link to the document and all of the supporting documentation that they'd used to create this. In that, they said that they thought that it was going to usher in a standard of excellence never before seen in healthcare, which, you know, was quite the statement, but they'd left out, as you say, woman, mother, baby, breastfeeding, pregnancy, childbirth, anything to do with midwifery at all, and had replaced it, all of these really valuable and treasured words for women and that say who we are, you know, who a midwife is actually supposed to care for, with whānau. So immediately you've got issues of clarity for midwives. Who are they supposed to look after? It just opens up a whole can of worms. Then you have to ask yourself why they're doing that and look at exactly what they're saying around that. And then we talked about the petition that was started by Deb Hayes. It was started in January. Deb Hayes is a midwife, a very brave midwife, who started a petition to ask that the government open an inquiry into both the functioning of the Midwifery Council and whether they're discharging their duties appropriately under the Act that provides for them, into the development of the scope of practice, because there were so many questions around that. You know, why would they want to delete the word for woman and both of our national languages, both in English and Te Reo, and of course for Manawahine Kōrero, who I belong to, and Di Landy, of course, one of the co-founders, along with Michelle Uriero, you know, we've taken an active stance against this since they released the previous iteration in November 22, which was exactly the same. They had no words for women and so on, and replaced them with whānau, and that's not okay by Manawahine Kōrero. You know, this is meddling with culture and language and fundamental concepts in a way that's really destructive. And so that's where we were at. And we were about signing the petition and trying to get public pressure, and that's what's happened. The public pressure has worked. 7,500 people, just under 7,500 people signed that petition. Once you do that, you then have to find an MP who is willing to present it in the House. And the National Party MP for Rangitata, James Meagher, stood up and, you know, good, all kudos to him. He didn't take a side. He just did his job, you know, which is to present the petition to the House. And then it can be formally looked at by a petitions committee, who then asked for written submissions. So we made, lots of people made them, and lots of women made submissions, but they asked the Midwifery Council, Manawahine Kōrero, and Deb Hayes to come and speak to the petition in front of the select committee that's considering it. And now what happens is that they go away and they consider everything that was said by all of us, and they make a determination about whether or not, which of the various recommendations, if any, they're going to make to the government to do with it. And so that might include suggesting or recommending to the government that they debate the petition in the House, which I would really like to see that in any circumstance, because I think open public debate on this is required. People need to understand what's happening. and they need to know about it so that they can contribute. This is a national discussion that needs to be had for the nation's women. You know, this is our conversation. So I'd love to see that. And of course, what we actually asked for, which was the open government inquiry into the functioning of the council and the development of the scope. They can recommend that. They can recommend changes to legislation or recommend that legislation is looked at. They can't actually compel that any of these things happen, but they make this recommendation, and then the government has 60 days to determine whether or not they're going to act upon it. And then they write back to the committee and they give them their reasoning. And all of this is public information. So anyone can access it and see the record. So that's really important that that's happened, because no matter what happens now, it's on the record that there was objections, serious, strongly held objections that were well evidenced. I mean, at some point, someone's going to have to look at this and go, if we don't do something, it's going to come crashing down. And it's going to be really bad when everybody finds out, you know, what the Midwifery Council has been up to and that we didn't do anything.
Summarise for me the oral submissions that you, Deb, and Di spoke about in committee this week.
Deb went first, and she was just so amazing. She was really calm and measured, you know, and just laid it out, a clinical case for the importance of sex-based language in midwifery. It took for the safety of women and babies, and she talked about the dyad of that relationship and that's who midwives care for. She made that really clear. She talked about the statements made by the council about in their written submissions, because we all made one to the committee, the council had put together a document and writing down what they had done, and they went into some detail because what happened in February was that they accepted essentially that they had to re-include. It was after 4.5 years it took to get them to do this, to put the words for women and wahine and babies back in the scope. And that was they finally went and sought legal advice. This petition had hit a number that you couldn't ignore anymore. And there were radio interviews. You and I had spoken. Deb was on a number of stations. When we called them out on this yesterday, they wrote in their explanation of what they'd done in February that they had sought the views of the Minister of Health. And then they proceed to say, you know, and then we took a unanimous decision to adopt the new scope with the words woman and baby re-included. And, you know, we're all very reasonable and we're doing, you know, we're just acting in good faith. And these people, you know, who are complaining, they're just, you know, some misapprehension. It's very sad, but of course we're doing the right thing. And that's kind of the general tone. But seeking the minister's views, the Minister of Health isn't permitted to be involved in the scope of practice in any of the regulatory health professions. It's supposed to be an independent process so that the change of government every 3 years doesn't change.
It's its continuity. The views that they would have sought at the time would have been those of Aisha Verrill, not of Shane Retty.
No, they say they sought the views of the Minister of Health, Dr. Shane Retty.
Dr. Shane Retty, right.
They know that he's not allowed to participate, and there's no suggestion that he actually did, you know. But it's kind of characteristic of, in fact, I've seen him tell them in writing that he's not allowed to do that. But it's kind of characteristic of how they write, you know, we sought the views of the Minister of Health and then we took a vote, and, you know, they're telling their midwives this.
So then it could be a case of they contacted his office, he sends a reply back saying he's unable to make comment in his position, and they are then communicating that back to midwives claiming, yes, we sought his advice, a bit like in media where they say we contacted them for comment and they declined type situation.
Yes, although they didn't tell the midwives that they declined. They don't say explicitly that he gave advice, but they don't say that he didn't, you know, and this is very typical of their interactions, you know. And so Deb was really great at kind of calling them out on that process that happened between November and February, where suddenly there's this flurry of activity in the Midwifery Council. You know, they're talking to the minister and they're talking to lawyers, and they write, you know, that they completely omitted to mention in their letter to the committee that they'd taken this vote in November, a unanimous vote, to adopt the scope of practice with no women in it. They didn't say anything about that, you know. They write that because at the time they'd added in this explanatory paragraph, which I always think is such a silly term. But in this explanatory paragraph, it just says, you know, our intention is always to look after wahine and pepe and woman person, you know, so no, nobody worry if this is all fine, and provide a definition for whānau, which it doesn't translate as. When they're doing all this, you know, and writing out their process, there's so many kind of obvious moments where you're just like, okay, can you stop pretending? You know, we can see that it's that you've been forced to do this, you know, to put woman and baby back in the scope. They've deleted completely the Te Reo Vote version of the scope. They won't let anybody see it anymore, which is a strange contradiction when the whole thing is supposed to be for the benefit of Māori women and Māori babies, you know, this is what their rationale is. Yeah, so Deb did a fantastic job of that, and Di spoke, and I can't wait until it's up on the parliamentary website, because it'll be available to view. And, you know, Di spoke really simply and clearly and well about the issues with translating wahine and pepe into whānau and making the whole family. Woman doesn't mean, wahine and whānau aren't transferable words, they're not interchangeable, you know. And she spoke really well and eloquently about that in a way that I think people can hear, really, you know, and understand, because the council talks all the time about their commitment to the Treaty of Waitangi and how they need to learn to understand what it means to be treaty partners, and, you know, they're really committed to the principles of whanaungatanga, and it's just all word salad. And then you hear Di speak and, you know, it's like something comes, you wake up, you're like, oh, yeah, that's the truth, you know, about whānau. I'm really looking forward to that being up so that people can watch that, because it's important, you know. They're using wahine Māori's, the poorer outcomes and unequal outcomes in maternity health to justify taking all the words for women out, you know, or replacing them, diluting them so that we're a subset of our own sex class, you know, to pregnant persons.
And not only that too, they also replaced the traditional Māori word for midwife with this new fictional word for midwife, which was gender neutral, essentially.
Yes, it's a gender neutral term for midwife, which, you know, there's so many questions about that term. I have lots of questions from a language perspective. I'm just like, how, you know, do you get that? And why? And then there's questions of who actually gifted that name. It was a man on the collaborative reference group actually developing the scope. He was there as a consumer, a midwifery consumer, this man. And it turned out that he is the husband of a senior midwife at the College of Midwives. You're immediately going, well, how did you get this position? You know, why are you, and did you get paid to be a consumer? And why are you the one that wound up gifting the name Kahu Pōkai?
Kahu Pōkai.
Two words, not hyphenated, not brought together in a portmanteau, just two words, Kahu Pōkai. And the intention, linguistically speaking, is to create a metaphorical term, you know, that you can, so because when you apply metaphor, you can stretch the meaning of words a lot further. And as far as we can make out, he has tried to create a term for midwife that matches the name that, as I understand it, the co-chair of the same group developing the scope gifted the whole council, which is Te Tato or Te Whare Kahu, and that was that. That's got its own metaphorical definition that the Midwifery Council have posted on their website, and it's about shields and shielding women, and this is what they say it's about: shielding women and elevating women to high-born status, and that it's a, like a gateway to this house of protection. But when you actually look at what these translations are and where they got this from, they've lifted definitions from very old definitions out of the Williams Dictionary, word for word, and then just changed one thing. So the shield element, there's multiple definitions. Kahu is one of those words that has a lot of, you know, when you look up some words in the dictionary, there's a lot of different meanings, and so you can apply them in different ways. But the number one meaning, of course, is hawk, the harrier, the Australasian harrier to be specific, which is a really big bird of prey. And then following on from that, you get cloaks of feathers and of different materials and for different purposes, some are ceremonial, that kind of thing. And then you get down to some other definitions where you start to see some relationship with birth, but it's not very nice. There's a whare kahu. There's no ancient text that can tell you what, you know, it's an oral culture. So, and it's not the same everywhere you go. There's dialectical differences and all of that as well. A friend of mine, I said whare kahu, and she said, oh, my grandma, she told me that was like quite unusual, that it was a shed for, you know, like really kind of high status women when they were having babies, you know, that they would go into this shed. And she said, but most of us, she said, my grandma told me most of us didn't do that. It was really straightforward. We just went away privately and had our babies, you know, out in the open, but safely, you know, but there wasn't a special hut built for us. But in the dictionary, that's what it's describing. It says, whare kahu, a hastily erected hut for the lying in health of high-born women. Now, the high-born women is a concept that the Midwifery Council talk a lot about equality. And well, they talk about equity. And we talked a little bit about this last time we spoke about the difference between equality and equity. And they talk a lot about this equity business. And yet there's something in their language that's really, it really reflects the opposite, you know, that they see themselves as high-born women, you know, as opposed to the woman that they're actually caring for. And then you get to this next bit, and that's related to birth and conception, and it's not about women really, it's about, so there's germination, there's egg white, there's the membrane enveloping the fetus, there's stillbirth. There's a few definitions that are, they don't feel good for a midwife, you know, so there's that. And then you go to Hawkeye, and that also has associations with birds and hosts of birds, although kind of esteemed birds. So here we have this high-born thing going on again, and you just got to ask yourself, you know, what is it that they're saying about themselves and about us in relation to all of this? Kahu Pōkai, I think, with this, especially with this conflict of interest between the college and married couples and a man on the, as a consumer, gifting this name, there are questions that need to be asked, and this is a discussion that needs to happen among wahine Māori. You know, what do these words mean? Is this what we want nationwide among all 103 iwi? And we've been saying that from the beginning. You know, Di and Michelle have made that crystal clear that these words need to be discussed. It's a really profound topic that goes to the heart of Te Ao Māori, you know, the role of women in family. It's not for the Midwifery Council to determine what these words mean on everybody's behalf, and it's certainly not for them to determine what they mean in Te Reo Māori, which is a vulnerable language, you know, internationally, and to redefine them as they please. And they insist, and they did it yesterday in their submission, they said, we're not redefining it. We're not redefining it. we're expanding the, you know, we've used it to, you know, to clarify our intent, you know, but that's still redefining it. Like,
yeah,
you know,
well, particularly when there's a perfectly good word, yes, midwife and Māori. So
yeah. we know of at least two, you know, wahine whakawhānau, whakawhānau being childbirth, and kai whakawhānau, you know, and certainly kai whakawhānau seems to be familiar to people.
Yeah, kai whakawhānau is the one I know. So
yeah, you know,
if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But they seem very intent on manipulating the language. Out of context, how many midwives are on the Midwifery Council, do you know?
There's not many. I think it's about 12 off the top of my head. Sometimes I get confused between the numbers on the council and the number on the CRG, on the scope group. But yeah, it's not many. It's under 20. It's a small number of people. Yeah, just coming back to the submissions quickly. I spoke to the language and to the culture, and Deb spoke to the clinical component and to also the obfuscation that they're engaging in around their process, and to the fact also that they're promising that they're going to, they've said that the scope is going to be enacted in October, less than a month from now, and they're ramming it into all midwifery education as we speak, and they promised that they would educate the midwives, but they haven't. You know, that she said, look, you know, they're saying all these things, but they're actually not delivering. So that was really, really great. And then my questions were about the relationships. I had questions about cost, the cost to the public purse, for all of this. We know that there was an application for $377,000 in the initial for 2 years' work, and that was in 2019. But we're in 2024, so there's obviously been more funding required, one would assume, for all the feedback and work that they've done and the lawyers and all of that stuff. The Midwifery Council is not a publicly funded body per se. They raise their own funds, but they apply, of course, for extra funding for things. So we want to know how much that has cost. And I also want to know what the relationship is between the Midwifery Scope of Practice project and the Trans Pregnancy Care project, which was run by Dr. George Parker at Victoria University in conjunction with Suzanne Miller at Otago School of Midwifery. And they had a number of people on the team. And Deb mentioned this as well. She said that there were, and I'll just check, and within this, so my questions were about the relationship, you know, as far as I'm concerned, this is my personal belief, that I think that they deliberately, George Parker and her team provided the evidence base for the scope.
Yes. Yeah. Because I think we mentioned George last time in terms of it appeared to be more activist than advocate. So just hold on, just back the track up for me a little bit. Trans Pregnancy Care Project, what on earth is that?
well, indeed.
An oxymoron on an oxymoron, if you ask me.
Well, yes. So, well, George Parker's program of research, so she's got a, so George identifies herself as non-binary, so already she's personally invested in this, you know, and she's a former midwife and quite a senior level midwife. She was able to be a clinical lecturer in midwifery at one stage in her career, and now she's a health service delivery lecturer at Victoria University, where she also gets to do research, quote unquote, because she gets paid for this. She generates, I've seen her say, we should say, I think it was in, oh, so it might have been the one she did on the breastfeeding, which was horrendous, but she's written, we should see if we can generate some research, you know, because that's about money on this. She gets paid. And for the Trans Pregnancy Care Project, they got $180,000 from the Ministry of Health. Her program of research focuses on the epistemological perspectives of queer and trans people in the places of care related to fertility, reproduction and family building, which is lifted pretty much straight from her website. And so I had to look up epistemological because I was like, I don't know what that means. And it means to do with reality, to do with whether or not the mind is simply projecting a fictional world, like in the Matrix, you know. So she's saying she studies the feelings and thoughts of people who think they're the opposite sex when they go to the maternity clinic. Now, obviously, the feelings of people who think they're the opposite sex when they go to the maternity clinic are going to be relatively confused. So what she has done is create a study with, I think it is 29 people and 20 interviews with a total number of participants, including one of the research team. And they talked about their experiences. One was a woman who thinks that she's a man in her experience of going to the pregnancy care clinic. And Dr. Parker went out into the Herald on Sunday in November 22 and did the same thing, promoted the Trans Pregnancy Care Project. She said they were looking at their experiences within maternity care and seeing how they could make that more comfortable for these people. So then they interviewed a woman who believes she's a man, she's married to another man, and they're trying to get pregnant. And she's taken a lot of hormones, and so she's got a beard and male pattern baldness, and she goes to the maternity clinic and she gets funny looks, and she says she feels like an imposter.
And that's even before you get to the complications of things like sterility and vaginal atrophy and uterine atrophy, because you've been taking all that testosterone.
Yes, and possibly she's had a double mastectomy, so she doesn't have any breasts and can't breastfeed.
For goodness
sake. So what she wanted to see, this woman, was the removal of all the words for mother. She didn't want to see any more of the unnecessary injection of femininity into maternity clinics. So I can only assume she means pink and flowers and pictures of pregnant women, you know. Just pregnant women. We're the ones that have the babies, and mm-hmm. you can have compassion for somebody's state of mind, you know, but you don't change all of the language of two languages and damage a vulnerable language and force this on all the midwives and put all of the women at risk so that this other woman doesn't feel confused, you know.
And that goes without just the wasteful spending. I mean, $180,000.
Well, it's important at the moment to say that what we're doing is asking questions. Yes. The petition is to ask for a government inquiry so that the government can ask these questions. You know, what was the relationship between the Trans Pregnancy Care Project, which appears to have provided the evidence base for the midwifery scope of practice, the reason they need to be inclusive, you know, the reason that they need to say pregnant person instead of pregnant woman, the reason that they're still putting whānau in there is to incorporate people who actually aren't, you know, family. You only get 10 minutes in these submissions, so there was a lot that we didn't say. But one of the things that there were three doctors involved, doctors of philosophy involved in the Trans Pregnancy Care Project, and one of them, and I did ask this question yesterday, sits on the Midwifery Council Professional Conduct Committee. And so we have a situation where there's a doctor of philosophy sitting on the conduct committee who's also interested in mandating cultural humility. So that's a question that needs to be asked. You know, is she still there? Does she still believe, you know, these sorts of there? And then we have Dr. Elizabeth Kirikiri, who's another philosophy doctor with a checkered past, you know, and she earned her doctorate, as we said, saying that there was no evidence of gender identity in pre-colonial Te Ao Māori, and then earns her living saying the opposite. You know, we know that there isn't any evidence of that. Anybody can look that up for themselves, and, you know, a proper historian. And then you've got Dr. Parker, and they all came out in this together. They co-authored with another midwife in January, at the end of January, just before. So the council was still fighting hard before February when we spoke, you know, to hang on. They said themselves that there was no specific definition of a woman in Chris Lynch media. And these three doctors came out into the spin-off, the ones that worked on the Trans Pregnancy Care Project, and they said that the scope without women in it and whānau, they said that whānau creates the conceptual conditions for midwives to expand their practice to diverse whānau. Now, you know, you pick this apart and it's you. What you're really saying is creating the conceptual conditions means we. If you do this, people are going to be so confused that they will believe that men can breastfeed. This is allowing for all kinds of unethical situations that you could force potentially a midwife to engage in that completely unethical and have no basis in clinical health or well-being or any of it. So we're talking about surrogacy. You know, surrogacy is fast becoming an industry where you have basically a workforce of women who is helping to facilitate what is essentially human trafficking. There's women, and what is obviously happening everywhere that surrogacy is starting to take hold is that women with fewer economic means being incentivized to have babies and to give them away to other people, at all cost to their own bodies, cost to the baby, who that relationship, you know, between a mother and a baby. There's grieving involved. And people like to think, you know, that surrogacy is for the wonderful family who've tried so hard to have a baby, but it's not, you know, always. Now we're looking at, you know, couples, two men can adopt a surrogate baby. So we're looking at a workforce that could potentially be really facilitating human trafficking and giving babies to men and without mothers or to, that's just, there's so many problems with that. And then you've got the issues of the Trans Pregnancy Care Project, where you're opening it up for a range of men who have fetishes, essentially, you know. They're autogynephiles. They receive a sexual pleasure from pretending to be women. And they will go to the extent of attempting to breastfeed a child and taking hormones to induce this. It's not breast milk, obviously. It's a hormonal discharge, and then attaching a baby to their nipple, and that's child abuse. Babies deserve food. A woman makes a complete food from her body without, you know, that's just how it is. It's got 3 million years of evidence-based reviews. Men don't breastfeed, and trying to make room for that. And you can really see it in the scope, you know, and especially in the Trans Pregnancy Care Project, you know, which she's talking about. And they went on to specifically say, Drs. Miller and Parker, who wrote the Trans Pregnancy Care Project, went on to then write a paper also at the same time that scope was being developed on specifically this, breastfeeding being expanded to anybody who has a body, or anybody who wants to feed a baby from their body should be provided with the assistance to do so. And no, they shouldn't. They shouldn't be provided with the assistance to do so. You know, that includes men. No.
Well, it's perpetrating a lie, a biological lie. But, I mean, let's face it, they've been perpetrating biological lies now for the best part of a decade. So why stop? Why stop now, Sarah?
Why stop? You know, and we said that too, that, you know, we don't have any reason to think that they're being transparent. They're not stopping. It's currently the subject of two committees. And what was really interesting listening to them afterwards was their confidence. They really thought they had this in the bag. You know, they came to the table and they were smiling, and they said, so you've read our submission, of course. So what we thought we'd do here today is if we just tell you a little bit about ourselves and about our scope, and, you know, that'll, and she kind of, the CEO, and she was smiling and cheerful, and, you know, nothing was a problem. And so she kind of went on like that for a few minutes, and eventually the chairperson of the select committee had to tell her that's not how it works. They weren't going to now discuss it all together, like, you know, the silly citizens who didn't understand had left the room, and they were going to have a proper discussion now, you know. he had to say to her, look, that's not how it works. What's going to happen is you present your evidence and then we go away and deliberate and make a conclusion. And there was this little silence, you know, and she went, oh, right, well, you've read our scope, and, you know, and then one of the select committee members asked really good questions. He asked, there's a section in here about trans men having babies. Is that a thing? Is that a thing that he was referring to? We estimate, based on Australian statistics, that there are approximately 6 to 12 New Zealand women who go through this experience of believing they're men and want to have some interaction with a maternity service or a fertility service. Whether or not that produces a baby, I don't know, but they have interaction. And so we put this in our submission, and he asked her, you know, what is that a thing? And she said, I don't know. They don't know, you know, they can't answer these questions. They said, you know, look, we did this to be inclusive, as though we didn't know that, you know, we.
So they've essentially done all of this based on, again, ideology, activism, and not on real world conditions and those suffering in the real world. Mothers?
Yes.
And midwives?
Yes.
And babies?
Yes, that's exactly right. You know, the death statistics, maternal mortality hasn't changed in 15 years, and 80% of women will suffer a birth injury. You know, ACC now covers birth injuries because it's so common. So these are the issues that they need to be concentrating on. And you're absolutely right about ideology. You know, the entire project, both projects, the Trans Pregnancy Care Project and the Midwifery Council Scope of Practice Project, are purely ideological and derived from the critical social justice theory of, you know, theories at universities. They're postmodern in nature, which is why George Parker is studying whether or not things are real.
I mean, as Elizabeth Rath has said last week, it's postmodernism is where intellectuals turn against their own intellect. And I think Dr. George Parker is probably a very good example of that. Yes. So where to from here? You've had these oral submissions. What's the next step for the petition and what is happening next?
So what happens now is that the petition select committee consider what everybody has said in the submissions, and they determine with what recommendations they're going to make. Once they've made a recommendation or not, the government has 60 days. Well, if they make a recommendation to the government has 60 days to reply and say, yes, we're going to do that, or no, we're not. The Midwifery Council are proceeding apace. They don't seem to be bothered by the processes that they're going through. So they are putting their education, so the scope is the foundational document for all of midwifery, including the education requirements. And so they've rewritten all of their education and competency standards on the basis of the scope. And it's currently going through a feedback process. And I know I've read some of that feedback, and it's not good. It's saying that there's issues of clarity, like the ones we've discussed, and that it needs to be changed, even if the scope has to be rewritten. Now, based on past performance, the Midwifery Council is simply just going to ignore that and carry on. But at some point, the government is going to need to make a decision. On balance, if I was them, you've got a rogue institution that's upsetting more and more people with their insistence on changing the language of birth and maternity care. And women are a powerful voting bloc. This affects all of us. And my hope is that the select committee will look and say, okay, well, there are simply too many questions here to be asked. We actually need to make this recommendation. Otherwise, if and when it all comes crashing down, the bucks will be stopping with us. I want them to do what they're supposed to do and kick it to the people who are supposed to deal with things like this, you know. Well, you know, I certainly hope they make that determination. And then the government, we've got this coalition government that is I think that this has been political considerations are going to come into play for them, and thus far they haven't shown a great deal of bravery. In fact, it's been the opposite in the main, with the exception of Tanya Unkevich and Winston Peters and a few others who are pushing back against these ideological ideas. Let's just hope that this seems, it's so illogical to do this to midwifery, that I'm hopeful that they may decide that this one they can actually run with, you know, that there's enough public support for them to stand up. Because if that doesn't happen and they say, well, thank you very much, but we're not going to do anything, then we're going to have to make a big fuss about that.
And the difficulty too for a lot of midwives is, you sort of kind of loosely touched on it before with the council, but what people need to realise is the midwifery council judge, jury and executioner over the careers of all midwives in New Zealand. So if you've got midwives that aren't a large enough block or group of them, and a lot of them are very, very fearful.
Yes.
If they, and you mentioned the psychologist before that was there, part of the reason that they're there is to look at their speech, behaviour, language and approach to midwifery. And if it doesn't conform to a certain ideological viewpoint, then they could come under censure of one form or another, which threatens a midwife's career. And essentially, these midwives just want to get on to deliver healthy babies and preserve the integrity of healthy mothers moving forward. You know, the threat, having that threat hang over you from this council is incredibly stressful. And I think they need everybody's support on this. Anyone that's concerned about maternity care in this country should be appalled by this. And that council is incredibly powerful. I've spoken to an obstetrician and gynecologist about this issue. And I said to them, I said, well, what are you doing about the language? And he said, I ignore it. They tell us that we should have non-genderized language. He said, I ignore it. He said, but I know one of these days a complaint will be laid and I will have to tackle that, you know, when the time comes. He said, and a lot of the midwives that I work with are doing exactly the same thing. They're running that gauntlet because it only takes one complaint of the 29 or so that the Trans Pregnancy Care Project or someone within that fold. It only takes one complaint to set the cat amongst the pigeons, and the council, you know, sets a precedent with that midwife. I mean, it is just absolutely authoritarian. It's awful.
It absolutely is, and it's very deliberate. And you know, I'm a psychologist. I'm a bit confused, but there's a doctor of philosophy, Dr. Miller.
Oh, philosophy. Sorry, yes, that was my mistake. Philosophy.
She's another one of the. Yeah, I'm pretty sure she's an equity theorist.
Oh, good grief. It goes from the ridiculous to the more ridiculous, really, Sarah. So, look, we will stay in touch over this because this is not over yet. I can definitely see it. There's still a lot more to continue here. And I know that you at Mana Wahine Kōrero, along with Di and Rex and everyone else there, have put in a huge amount of work with us. And thank you for all the work that you have done. And then we'll just have to see what happens. And so where's Deb at? She's just waiting to see what happens in regards to from the petitions committee. So hopefully, did they give you a time frame of when you'll expect news?
No, they didn't. I'm not expecting anything in a hurry. You know, they do take a while. But I just want to say that, yeah, everything you just said about the midwifery profession is absolutely right. You know, we're so lucky in New Zealand. To have the midwifery service that we've got. So many women around the world don't have lead maternity carers. You know, they don't have this continuity of care. They don't have, we've actually got a woman-centered maternity service, and midwives are lovely. You know, they're actually, they love their jobs. And it's because, of course, you're involved in this really special moment, and of course they don't deserve to have this hanging over them. You know, we do need to defend them or we'll lose them. We'll lose them because the council is behaving in a way that, regardless of what happens now, and how terrible it is. It's doomed. It's a doomed strategy for an institution. And whatever they do, if they don't listen, they're going to eventually crumble, and that would be a tragedy. Yeah.
It certainly would. It certainly would. Look, this has been Sarah Henderson from Manawahini Kōrero. We've been discussing the petition that was discussed in Parliament. It was tabled. It was discussed in Select Committee this past week. Sarah, thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.